Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and I am sitting in his gorgeous hotel room at the Hotel Valley-Ho with Stephen Hunter. And what I really want to do, instead of talking to Stephen, is take a bath in this great bathtub in the middle of the room. But we're going to keep our clothes on and talk about it. And you. So I saw you just a little while ago, Stephen, at Thriller Fest in New York, where you were interviewed by James Grady.
It was a great pleasure for me. Jim has been a good friend for many years. He's a wonderful guy if you're lucky enough to know him. He's sort of obscenely generous and supportive. I really don't deserve a friend in that category. Yet all my friends are like that. I don't know why these people put up with me, but somehow they do.
It's your charm.
Who knows?
How did it feel to be somebody? That was a big room with like hundreds of people there to admire you.
It was lots of fun. I've never really been a community joiner. I wasn't a member of the group. I'm not a convention goer. I'm not a schmoozer. I'm not a, hi, I'm Steve Hunter kind of guy. But it was so nice to be in a community of peers and to meet people that were heroes to me, and to pretend like I was a hero to some other deluded fools. And it was just a really terrific week for me, one of the best of my life, to be dead honest. They were so nice to me. I'm still astounded.
You were in great company with John Sanford and Harlan Coben.
Well, indeed I was. And at one point I said, these guys are great. What am I doing here? But they seem to think that's where I belong, so I was happy to pitch in and pretend like I believed it myself.
I do think you deserve the honor.
You've been one of
my favorites for years, and in fact, today, before our conversation, I went back and looked up how long we've been together. I think it's 21 years. We started with Time to Hunt in 1998.
It's been a long time, and it's always been a treat to come here. In fact, I believe, but my memory is somewhat holy these days, that I've jumped every novel off with a nice experience at the Poison Pen, and you've given me some very nice experiences.
Well, thank you. I think one of my favorite experiences was, and we were talking about it a little while ago, with Hot Springs in 2000, when we got a gun permit from the city of Scottsdale so we could set up a whole shooting range in our parking lot.
That was fun. I mean, that was brought all my interests together. Well, not all, but most of my interests together. And it was a total immersion in something I probably had never been done before and probably will never be done before. But it was great. It was just a great experience.
I had a funny email from your publicist that was then, you were then at Simon & Schuster. After I sent her a report, she wrote back and said, from now on, you're our go-to bookstore for all shooters. You know, but the reason I think it might have been 2000 was because I'm not too sure after 2001 that we would have been able to actually bring it off.
That's probably true. It's probably true.
On other occasions, you actually brought some of your best guns and we showed them at the store, and that was very meaningful.
That was fun too. It's always a good time.
My favorite, still, of all your books is The 47th Samurai.
Mm-hmm.
I think I loved it because you brought Earl and Bob Lee together without actually being together. You started off Earl and Iwo Jima,
yeah.
Isn't it? And then, of course, you had a segue to Winnetka, where I grew up, so
yeah.
That was sort of fun, too.
Yeah.
But I think that the real question in that book, of course, was how was Bob Lee going to deal with not a sniper, but a swordsman? And I thought your solution to that was amazingly clever.
Well, thank you very much. Again, that was a great, that was fun to write. I think of it not as an American thriller, but as a Japanese samurai movie. It gets away with the stuff that is regularly gotten away with in samurai movies. And if you read it in that spirit, I think you'll have a good time. I just wanted to build towards a sword fight. I'd seen Kill Bill. And I've really enjoyed that movie, but it's kitsch. You know, it's over exaggerated. It's played for laughs. It's not, you even as it's unspooling before your eyes, you know it's not happening. So my goal in that book was to write a book in which two men in modern downtown Tokyo have a samurai sword fight to the death, and there's nothing kitsch about it. There's nothing meta about it. It's not clever. It's a real literal, you know, exhausting, sweaty, bloody battle to the death. And that in that respect, I would have to judge that it was a successful book.
If I remember right, you actually had set up Bob Lee to be able to have this sword fight in an earlier book, but I might be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure you did.
I did, although when I did what you're referring to, it wasn't because I had this in mind in the future. It was just something I put in because it seemed right. And then later, I saw how useful it could be. And you never want to forget or throw anything away, because a lot of my books play with things that has been established in other books. But when they were established, I didn't establish them because I'm so darn smart, but just because I thought that was interesting in and of itself. So.
And incredibly useful. Do you remember I wrote to you when I was on page like 162 and I said, "Dear Steve, I'm pretty sure I know how this is going to go." And
some other people got it too.
Yeah.
But I think one of the pleasures there is not is seeing if you're right. And
yes.
You really enjoy it if you're right, you know. So.
Well, yes, I must admit that I really did enjoy being right. But it also, you know, the other benefit it was almost as though you could see the end of the road. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, as you were going towards it, you got to enjoy the fact that you were pretty sure what the destination was going to be. It's just a lovely book. The other thing I love about it, so it's a really good World War II book.
Well, thank you. And I...
In the Japanese theater,
yeah.
Because so much right now we're in this deluge of them,
yeah.
And they're all in the European theater.
That's exactly true, and this sounds ridiculous, but it's true. I love World War II. I mean, for novelists, it's dramatic, it's gigantic, it's heroic, it's violent, it's full of themes of loyalty and passion and honor. It's got some really cool uniforms in it. And I just, you know, it's just so much fun to write about it and to try and find little aspects of it which haven't been used yet. And there are some left, believe me.
Well, you went on to write another book in which you go to World War II, but it's the Russian and the German theater.
And I had, my first book was set in World War II, The Master Sniper. Then I did Sniper's Honor. I still hate that title. And I had just recreating. We don't know what happened in the Russian front, or at least not enough of us do. But that was really Armageddon. That was the war out of Lord of the Rings. It was orcs and hobbits fighting on an immense scale to the death across an immense landscape with immense weapons of war. Men died in the thousands every day. Something like 4 out of 5 men in World War II who died on the Russian front. It's an amazing statistic, but I believe it's true.
I ever tell you that I've been to Murmansk, where they have an American cemetery?
Yes.
For the people that, you know, that's not the Western Front, it's the, you know, Arctic Front,
yeah.
But still. I thought the Russian Sniper and Sniper's Honor was great, but do you know the character that still chills me is the German officer bureaucrat whose job it was to send people on trains to death camps, and, you know, for him it was all about, like, the railroad timetable.
Yeah.
And I thought you wrote about him so, you know, straightforward, but it was so chilling the way he was dealing with it, you know.
Nazism in its purest form is frightening, it's terrifying, it's repulsive, yet it is also charismatic, and it draws me back to it over and over again. And I actually have somewhere in my memory bank another World War II novel idea. I tried to write it and there was no interest in publishers at that time, and I'm hoping maybe a few books down the road I'll get back to it.
Tell me about a book called The Citadel that you wrote. It's a small book you wrote specifically for Otto Penzler.
That
I got copies for us this
good,
evening.
Good. Yeah, that one was also great fun. I had betrayed Otto. He asked me to write a book for a series he was doing called Biblio Mysteries, and it was a mystery novella over 100 pages long, or close to 100 pages long, that dealt with some aspect of the book trade. Book collecting, old books, fine books, book stealing, book, I don't know, counterfeiting, I suppose. And I came up with this idea for a Jack the Ripper book, and I sold it to him, and he was enthusiastic. The more I thought of it, the more my gears in my mind clicked, until it clicked into something I really liked a lot. And so I called him and I said, Otto, I can't do this for you. I'm going to try and sell it to Simon & Schuster. It's just too exciting. And he, you know, he had no problem with that. And so I went ahead and I wrote the book. And I promised him that I'd write another book for him when I was done. So I wrote that book for Simon & Schuster. And then it was my turn to write the Biblio Mystery for Otto, and I tried and I tried and I thunk and I thunk, and my little head got sore. I tried so hard and I could come up with nothing. So I sent him an email and said, boy, I hate to let you down twice in a row, but I have nothing. I just don't know what I'm going to do. There's nothing here. And he was actually upset. I mean, he's such a merry, witty, ironic, clever guy. I never think of a person like that having actual emotions, but he was bitter and he was angry at me, and that hurt me very badly. And somehow it got something going, and I came up with an idea, and it was the idea that eventually became Citadel, set in World War II, about a British agent who parachutes into occupied France, and he's got to rescue a certain volume from a library in Paris that holds the key to a code. And it turned out to be a sort of a structural nightmare. So I took its weakness and made it into a strength. The setup was so elaborate and had so many, you know, codicils and addendum and reinterpretations, that it literally, if I'd written it straight, the setup would have been 90 pages and the story would have been 10 pages. But what I did was I integrated them so that as you're learning the setup, you're seeing the first chunk of the story playing out. Back to setup, back to story, back to setup, back to story, until finally you find out what it's all about right at the end. And that's the climax of the book, really, is finding out what this has been about all this time. And I believe that gives you a nice sort of moment when it's a different kind of climax for me. It's not the climax where someone's head is blown off. I would do that later. It's the kind of climax where the final part of the puzzle is revealed. And I believe that that's, that's a very hard kind of book to write. I believe I was able to write it in that particular one, and I'm secretly very proud of that. And he liked it too, and he's still speaking to me, so I consider it on all fronts a success.
Well, I love it, so it was a triple win all the way around. The other book I think is really interesting that is not a swagger is a book you wrote called Night of the Hunter, which involves a car as well. I have reread the last three pages of that book probably 20 times because I just love the way you did it. But it takes place in Bristol, Virginia, at the Bristol Speedway, where I once lived, and where, if I remember right, is it your daughter was working for the Bristol Herald Courier?
That is exactly right. And I went down there with my wife and we visited her. And we thought if we're going to visit her in Bristol, we ought to do it on a NASCAR weekend. So we went down there and I was blown away by the immensity, by the seriousness, by the depth of passion, engagement, and by, above everything else, the incredible night spectacle of a huge NASCAR race at night. And so I thought to myself, Wouldn't it be fun to steal something in the middle of all this? So this book is about a it's a heist book about a heist in the middle of the huge Bristol 500. And I will say that I went down there and gave a little talk about it. One of the people who showed up was the guy who runs the Bristol Speedway. And he said, this book is about you stealing from me, and I love it. I don't know what's wrong with me. That made me really happy. And it was not one of my more successful books, because I think people thought that I was just ripping off NASCAR culture, which was, of course, was and is and always will be big for my own crass commercial reasons. And of course, I was ripping off NASCAR for my own crass commercial reasons. So they had a point, but it was a lot of fun to write.
It was a lot of fun to read, and he was a different kind of, you know, hitman with a different weapon. Which I think is fun. I mean, I love your sniper books, but I do think that you really are very creative about other sorts of protagonists villains. And, you know, let's face it, Steve, to make a really good thriller, you need a particularly good villain.
Yeah, no, thank you. And maybe I will sometime put the rifles away, but damn it, I still like rifles a whole lot, so I probably won't.
So we're here to talk about this evening Snipers game.
Game of Snipers.
Game of Snipers. There you are. Which we can't discuss, really has a very interesting ending. It's sort of a double bluff by you.
Uh-huh.
But you'll be interested to know that my husband read it while we were in Santa Fe, and we sent a correction to your editor about the altitude. You were 1,000 yards.
Well, you're the one who sent that.
Yep, you were 1,000 yards too low for New Mexico, where the lowest point is 2,800 feet.
Yeah, I remember. He got that, and he sent it to me, and I have to look at it. Well, since you're the source, you can tell me what it should read, and then I'll tell him. It should
just
be 2,800.
Just up it by 1,000, you know.
Okay. And I said 1,800?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that was
so,
easy.
Anyway, I really enjoyed
there
that.
There you go.
Never.
Yeah, people love to correct authors. It's such a thrill. Sometimes the best part of the book is writing the 18-inch essay review for Amazon.com, in which they point out that they know something that this guy didn't know. I've had that happen too many times, but everybody does.
It was actually my husband whose only interest was in protecting New Mexico, because he lived there for so long. So you're a Pulitzer Prize winning movie critic, and you have written some nonfiction too. I remember American Gunfight in particular.
I had always wanted to do a long nonfiction piece on a gunfight, starting at the beginning, which would be the childhood of the guys, and ending at the end, which would be the death of the guys, and following it through all its ramifications and the impact it had on society. And I had always known about this obscure attempt on Harry Truman's life in 1950, which resulted in a very violent gunfight at Blair House, November 1st, 1950. And I was thinking about it, and I thought I would look up the standard book and see what the consensus was, see if there was room for another book. Well, I discovered there was no standard book. And this was a time when several of the survivors were still alive. They were elderly men, but they were still kicking and, you know, rooting and tooting. And I knew that we had to get to them before they died. It was just a matter of reality that the book would be unwritable 5 years down the road. So I went to my agent, Esther, and she went to Simon & Schuster, and they all agreed with it. And it was, so we made it happen. I wrote it with a friend of mine who was a lawyer and a very thorough guy who is a good researcher, an indefatigable researcher, and he did a very good job. We looked at this at a depth in which it's never been looked at since or before, and we were able to dispel many of the myths. We were able to interpret in other ways many of the events as they had been interpreted then, and in my opinion, they still were. we were able to understand the ballistics of the event, because gun events do often involve what the guns are capable of and what they're not capable of. And I thought we did a very good job of doing that. Now, when it came to the actual fight itself, I tried something new. I tried to ride it as they would have experienced it, which would have been 38 seconds without taking a single breath. And I expressed that in a 10-page chapter that was written without any punctuation or capitalization, because for them, it was just an incredible rush of experience and things happening faster than light. And I wanted to capture that aspect of it. Did it work? Well, some people think it did, other people think it didn't. And in fact, at one point I went to the editor, to the publisher, David Rosenthal, and I said, would we do it in paperback? Maybe I had to do that again. He said, no way, this is what you decided, so you have to stick with it. So that's one of very few things in my career that I have second thoughts about. I'm not saying it was wrong. I still think in theory it works very well. And in fact, maybe now in much colder, I might pull it out of my bookshelf and read it again and see what I think.
Sometimes distance really helps. I am of an age to remember when it came on the news in 1950. And, you know, they were in Blair House because the White House was having some renovations.
Correct.
And it was the Puerto Ricans were involved in the Secret Service and so forth. And it was really interesting. You know, I hated the fact that my life has turned into history.
Yeah.
We're almost the same age, so although I'm older. So, you know, it don't you find that to be somewhat unnerving?
Annoying is what it was. Everything annoys me these days, but that is particularly annoying. And particularly when you see people who weren't there refer to a certain age as having been a certain way, but you were there and you know that it wasn't that way at all. That somehow summaries and evocations and archival footage and sonorous narratives somehow missing things that were in the air that you could feel then. I don't think anyone has ever gotten, for example, 1968 right. And to me, 1968 had a very specific feel to it, a very specific color scheme to it. And it's, you know, it's a famous American year, and books have been written about it, and it continues to fascinate people. And yet I still don't think anyone's gotten it correctly.
And yet you wrote a book called G-Men, in which you went back to 1930, which was it, two or three?
This is true.
The bank robbery year.
There are certainly people who were children then who may read that book and say what I just said about me. And you know, it's just one of the puzzles or enigmas of prose that somehow you can't get it perfect. You know, something is always wrong. There's some discordant note. I had a song in G-Man. I put it on the radio in 1934, and it wasn't released until 1944. So some guy wrote a 90-inch review on Amazon.com, you know, accusing me of being the worst war criminal since Adolf Eichmann because I got that wrong. And I did switch it and the truth is, things like that don't matter except for the fact that they do matter. You know, you say, oh, that doesn't really matter. But if it disrupted and destroyed any hope of getting a enchantment going with that reader, then it did matter.
That's a very good point. You know, and all history obviously is filtered, you know, through you or anybody else. So sometimes things matter more to one person. Well, they always matter more to one person than another.
That's right.
There you are. Your other historical, Eye Ripper, I think is absolutely fascinating. You got completely caught up in the whole Jack the Ripper didn't you?
I had always had a Jack the Ripper thing. I read a book about him in about 1973 or 4, And I found it fascinating and really much more fascinating than I was expecting to, because I thought I knew everything about him, and in fact, I knew nothing about him. I love the era. I love, you know, it was Britain on the cusp of the Bloomsbury Group. It was England as modernism was being invented. It was also the London of Sherlock Holmes. It was the London of it was the world capital of prostitution. It was a very violent, exploitative era, and yet it was covered over with a veneer of gentility and style. And I love the gentility, and I love the style, and I love the language. So for me, it was a real, and the other thing is I found out how much fun I had pretending I was writing Victorian English. I don't know where that came from. It just seemed to naturally pop into my head, and I just writing it was, again, in and of itself, so interesting. And I came up with lines. I thought to myself, how on earth could I come up with that line? That line is so much beyond me. But there it was, and it was just, it was a nice experience. Book didn't do as well as I had hoped, didn't catch on. It was the kind of book that needed a special, someone special to notice it and pay special attention promote it against all odds. And you can't count on that happening. It almost never happens. Sometimes it does happen. It didn't happen for that book. But again, it's one of my books that I think will always be in the mix and will sell in small quantities for years and years.
Well, at the end of the day, it's good for you to write something that's not a swagger book.
That's true.
Because otherwise,
is indeed true.
Yeah, and I think your forays, and I don't think you can judge them about how they sold, but rather how satisfied you are with them. And you don't want to be known for just one thing.
For someone so young, you're so wise. I don't get it.
I think on that note that we should go off and do our event this evening. Thank you very much, Stephen, for talking to me.
It was my pleasure.